Brett Moore from World Vision is going to come and make another case study for us, which he will explain. Brett is the shelter and infrastructure advisor to the World Vision program in Australia.
Thanks, sir. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for the opportunity to present this work. As David mentioned, I'm the Shelter and Infrastructure Advisor with World Vision. I'm based in Melbourne, and originally, just as means of introduction, I'm an architect. Well, now I refer to myself as a lapsed architect or reformed architect, depending how you see it. That's right. So I had, you know, I'm originally a Melbourne University graduate from 18 years ago and had worked in the private sector in Melbourne and then jumped ship about 12 years ago and started doing development work, and then more recently, last 8 or 9 years, this humanitarian work. The last 2 years I've been with World Vision, and I had the previous kind of 5 years or so with the UN and worked in a bunch of countries in Africa and the Middle East and Asia. So this was the first exposure that I had had to East Africa, though. This project began as part of the Horn of Africa drought response. So it was nearly 2 years ago that I began this work. We had a program in Somalia, but because of the ongoing conflict and drought, the nature of that work had changed. Somalia, just to give it some context, is one of those countries that we refer to internally as a fragile state. Now, it's neither a humanitarian context nor a development context. It kind of falls in the middle. We have about 8 countries we work in that kind of come under this banner of fragile state or fragile context. That's just kind of to frame a little bit. Really, to give the context of the work that we were doing there, really there are drought issues. There'd been a long and prolonged drought of varying kind of intensities over several years. But Somalia itself is really a desert country. It's lowland, and it really extends up to the edges of highland Ethiopia. So as part of the kind of post-colonial carve-up, what really is now part of Kenya, part of Ethiopia, and part of, say, northern Tanzania, it really is Somali territory and has been for, you know, centuries, I guess. We also have, as mentioned with the drought, a protracted livelihoods crisis. Complicated clan issues. Now, for those of you that have been working in East Africa and maybe some other places as well, clan, well, tribe, really are the primary governance systems. Just to step back 1 second, really, in this presentation, I'll really concentrate on the aspects of culture, conflict, and climate change. So I won't look too much at the construction or the design or anything like that. For me, they were byproducts, but really these kind of context issues are the distinguishing features of this project that are kind of interesting to pick apart. So the clan structure in Somalia have clan, sub-clan, and even sub-sub-clan. And the same as in South Sudan or many other places in that area, there is no such thing as Somalia once you're in Somalia. People will say, I'm a Dawood, or I'm a Mahabsanid, or, you know, whatever clan they belong to. There is no concept of Somalia. In fact, even Somalia as a political entity, it hasn't really existed for nearly 30 years. In Somalia, there's Somaliland, there's Puntland, and there's South Central. I hope this pointer works. So this area here is known as Somaliland, the capital of which is Hargeisa. And they haven't really had that much internal strife for 10 years or more. It's quite stable and got a thriving economy. This area here, right up to Basaso and in the Gulf of Aden, which is opposite Yemen here, this is called Puntland. And then down here, which is really the most conflict-ridden area, is called, collectively kind of known as South Central, but there's a few breakaway, I suppose, states there, one called Jubaland and a few others in the last couple of months. I had spent 4 months here in a large refugee camp called Dolo Addo as operations manager. Then after I'd finished that work, some basic assessment had taken place in Puntland, where we had an office for a couple of years, and they said, we think that there's a shelter project that could begin here. So then I went across to Puntland and I stayed in this town here, Garraway, which was the unofficial capital of Puntland. I spent 3 months there doing the assessment and developing the project. So I'll just talk particularly about that phase. Here's Mogadishu down here. The first part really was about stakeholder engagement. So establishing a project like this in a country that hasn't had a central government for nearly 30 years, your primary point of contact are the local community groups. In a place like Somalia, even in Puntland, they have had a nascent government there for around 8 years, but it doesn't really hold much legitimacy. So trying to identify your stakeholders and who you're really working with, who you can create a project around, is the way you have to start. You can't rely on government because it doesn't really function and barely exists. There's only about 12 people in the government there as such in Puntland. So really working with the Council of Elders and the Sharia Courts, the local community, that is the beneficiary community and the host community, they're the primary points of contact through which you can develop a project. The project itself was... the finance from which came from various humanitarian funds, mostly ECHO, the European Commission Humanitarian Fund, and the DEC, the Disaster Emergency Committee, which is a conglomeration of, I think, 10 donors that support emergency projects, and some internal money from World Vision. The Sharia courts are the real primary governance mechanism in most of Somalia. As I mentioned, with a lot of the East African communities, they're primarily nomadic agro-pastoral communities. And really from the 1950s onward, there has been a substantial change at the kind of overarching level. We've going through a process, as outlined by Graham this morning, of urbanisation. So the project was working within that context. Also, the Somali clan structure really is derived from that agro-pastoralist identity. That is, the more cattle, goats and camels you own, the higher your social status in the community. Now, with the drought and the conflict, most of the clan and clan groups had lost their livestock and kind of condensed into informal settlements around these towns. So the two towns where I was working, Butinle and Garraway, we thought we had basically enough money to do 1,200 houses. Land in Somalia is collectively owned. There's no individual land ownership in Somalia. And there's also, according to Sharia law and the nascent Somali constitution, women are not allowed to own land or property in Somalia. So we had two fairly large institutional barriers to work through. So back to the stakeholder engagement process and deciding who we could work with, it was these key groups who would in the end decide where we could get land and who we could work with.